Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Did you by any chance read Bill Buford's book, Heat? Part of it's about him cooking in one of Mario Batali's restaurants. One night he sees Mario ream out his cooks for tossing celery stalks and leaves into the trash. And to make his point, Mario cooks up a dynamite pasta dish with those stalks and leaves. Well, call this a cook who can't stand waste, or call it frugality flipped over into ingenuity. But either way, stick around, because we're going to be doing some great things with what we usually throw out. And there's much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is supported by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at splendidtable.ting.com.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're in tomato nirvana. Local tomatoes are going full tilt. We're eating so many homegrowns, we're practically turning red. But with all this romping around, there's a side of the tomato you don't hear about. Barry Esterbrook is an investigative journalist. His website is Politics of the Plate. In 2009, he set out to get the answer to a question we've all asked. Why can't we get a good-tasting tomato in the winter? Well, he went to Florida because that's where most of our winter tomatoes grow. He came back with a much larger agenda, which became his book, Tomatoland. The subtitle is How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. Barry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So on that first trip, what did you find?
Well, surprisingly, Florida is probably the worst place in the world to grow commercial tomatoes from a horticultural or botanical point of view. And that the only reason tomatoes are growing there is that it's within a day or two's truck ride from two-thirds of the nation's population in the wintertime.
Why is it such a terrible place?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One reason is that Florida is notoriously humid year-round. And the ancestors, the wild ancestors of tomatoes, were in fact desert plants from the western coast of South America. So they're just not suited for humid conditions. Every blight, fungus, mold, canker, rust, you name it, and every insect pest just thrives in those conditions. And the tomatoes don't do very well at all. The second problem is that in Florida, most tomatoes are grown in sand. I don't mean sandy loam or sandy soil. I mean sand that has no more nutrition in it than the stuff you see on Daytona Beach. So everything has to be fed to them.
So this means pesticides, fungicides, fertilizer, etc., right?
Well, the official Florida government handbook for commercial tomato growers lists more than 110 pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides that can be spread on a field of tomatoes over the course of the season. And some of them are the EPA's most toxic chemicals, Category 1 acute toxins. Basically means they can kill you.
But isn't that illegal to use those?
It's not illegal to use those. They're used all the time in agriculture. Problem in Florida is they're used so heavily. Florida and California grow about the same quantity of field tomatoes, slicing tomatoes. Florida's growers apply eight times as much pesticide in order to get a crop than California's growers.
So what does this mean to the people who are working in the fields?
Well, that's a tragedy. There are laws that are supposed to protect them. There are periods of time where you're not allowed to have workers come into the fields. Unfortunately, in Florida, that's often violated or ignored. And I must have talked to 3 or 4 dozen workers. When I'd ask them, "Oh, have you ever been sprayed?" they'd look at me and say, "Well, every day, man. It's just part of being out there." You're waging basically chemical warfare against all the pests on your tomato fields. And that means you have to spray weekly. And I guess sometimes you do that whether workers are out in the fields or not. There was one case a few years ago where 3 women who were neighbors in this little work camp and were all pregnant at the same time, they were forced to work from the beginning to the end of their pregnancy. They had no choice. Their boss said, "If you don't want to work, you're going to get kicked out of the trailer that you live in." Of course, they needed a home for their babies. All 3 of them, within a couple of months of each other, gave birth to badly deformed babies. One died. One has no arms or legs. And one had a serious deformity of the jaw.
You say something in the book, I'm quoting you here. "If you've ever eaten a tomato during the winter, you've eaten a fruit picked by a slave."
Well, that wasn't my opinion. That was the opinion of the U.S. District Attorney for Southwestern Florida. He was the one that told me that. I sort of asked him, "Is there a chance you've done this?" And he looked at me and said, "You absolutely have done it." And that's the darkest corner of the tomato industry in Florida, is that slavery does exist there to this day. And, in the last 10 or 15 years, there have been 7 cases of slavery successfully prosecuted in Florida, and 1,200 people have been freed from slavery. And we're talking being bought and sold, being held in chains, being beaten if they didn't want to work, being shot in some cases if they tried to escape. The law tries, but it's very, very difficult to prosecute slavery cases. As that district attorney said to me, he said, "Slaves don't come out and report themselves."
So, Barry, are there any responsibly grown tomatoes coming out of Florida?
Well, there's been an interesting sea change in the last several months. Last fall, after years of resistance, the major tomato growers, there's only about a dozen in the state, the major tomato growers all agreed to a Fair Food Code of Conduct, which basically is an enforceable system where things like slavery, there's a means to report that. Medical training for some people in the fields, guaranteed shade, things like that, and a increase in wages from a penny and a half a pound to 2.5 pennies a pound, or the difference between $40 or $50 on a good day and $80. You know, the difference between not being able to feed your kids and a shabby but survivable income.
So what can we consumers do?
Well, first and foremost, I think we should try to eat tomatoes that are grown close to our homes and seasonally. That's the way we get the best tomato, and that's the way that you have the best assurance that the people who picked it were fairly treated. Secondly, the supermarket industry has not supported the tomato growers' Fair Food Agreement, so it's very difficult to get a supermarket tomato that you can be assured of in terms of the labor that produced it. So I would say in that case, I would look at a hydroponic tomato, where the only problem is some of them don't taste very good. Well, neither do field-grown tomatoes in the wintertime. But this way, at least you know that the people who picked it were treated fairly, and hydroponic tomatoes aren't splashed with these chemicals.
Barry, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
You You can find more information on Barry Esterbrook's book, Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit, on the website. And while you're there, get registered for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's a copy of Morocco, A Culinary Journey with Recipes by Jeff Kohler. That's splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern, Bird Dog, The Survivors, the hometown places that still survive in spite of the chains. They tally them on their website, roadfood.com, and come by here to tell all. Hey, Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hey, Lynn. You know, the world has finally rediscovered pimento cheese. Now, you guys have been on this for a while, right?
We have. And, you know, I have to say that growing up in the Midwest, to me, pimento cheese was what came in the little jar from Kraft. That's all I knew about it. It was only when we traveled into the South that we discovered how wonderful and how varied pimento cheese can be.
And growing up in Midtown Manhattan, I never heard of it. I had not a clue what it was. But now I'm quite glad that I have been inducted into the cult of pimento cheese.
Why don't you explain?
Well, it's some kind of cheese, usually some sort of cheddar, maybe a couple of types of cheese, mixed with little pieces of pimento, which, as you know, Leonard, is probably the most flavorless pepper there is on earth. It's kind of colorful. So you got the orange and red thing going. But what makes it interesting is that beyond that, people season it with horseradish, little bits of pickle, pepper,
mayonnaise.
Mustard. Mayonnaise is almost always part of the formula. And then you can do all kinds of things with it. You can serve it as an hors d'oeuvre. You can make a lovely sandwich just of pimento cheese. You can make pimento cheese and bacon on grilled bread, which is fabulous. Or there was a restaurant out on Edisto Island, South Carolina, that claimed to have invented what is now very popular, the pimento cheese burger.
I thought you were going to say the pimento cheese pizza, which we invented.
We invented that,
When we went to that restaurant, we said, can you take your pimento cheese and put it on your pizza dough? And it was quite good.
Huh. So is there a pinnacle pimento cheese experience for you two?
Yeah.
Merity's
bread basket?
Merity's is in Franklin, Tennessee. It's a lovely little bakery. You know, they bake all kinds of breads and stuff. What's wonderful to me about that is that it's kind of classical pimento cheese. It's not too spicy. Plenty of mayonnaise. It's nice and orange, and it's got just enough flecks of red in it to look festive.
I think pimento is sort of the maraschino cherry of the pepper world. I mean, it's really. I mean, sometimes I wonder if you left it out of the recipe, if anybody would even notice if you were blindfolded.
I'll tell you, one of the strangest and best pimento cheeses is in Charleston, South Carolina, at a restaurant called Magnolia's, where they add a lot of chopped up olives to it. You know, green olives. And that adds a whole other dimension to the flavor of pimento cheese.
It's also served in a little timbal. I mean, it's,
you kind know, of fancy.
Charleston can be pretty swanky, fancy. But, you know, it used to be one of these Southern specialties that absolutely every hostess in the South, if you came over, would serve pimento cheese as an appetizer. And now, you know, like so many things, it's got legs and it's spreading all over the country.
Well, I think now it's just going to spread a little more. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds and the mouths behind roadfood.com. Now, you can find cookbook maven Deborah Madison's recipe for pimento cheese on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, is there a mainstream use for celery leaves? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This podcast is supported by Ting, the new mobile service that makes sense. Ting brings billing clarity, usability, and savings to mobile phone users. Ting bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. If you use less than anticipated, you are automatically credited the difference at the end of the month. Ting has no premiums or penalties. You don't pay for more than you use. Go to splendidtable.ting.com and save $50 on your device. That's splendidtable.ting.com. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When writer Francis Lamb takes on a project, I like to follow it. He writes about food with attitude and a solid lustiness. The man likes to eat. Well, Francis is the features editor of GuiltTaste.com, where they recently began a section called Eat Shoots and Leaves. Francis, welcome back.
Hi.
So where did this idea, Eat Shoots and Leaves, come from?
You know, we have so much talk about eating nose to tail and meat, and people are interested in the offal. And, you know, I grew up eating a lot of that stuff, and I've always loved it. And I was like, yeah, finally, people are catching on to this thing. And then one day I was cutting vegetables, and I thought, well, kind of we do the same thing with vegetables. We're throwing out so much of the trim, of the peel, of all these things that we think of as trash, when lots of traditions and lots of cultures use these parts. I mean, one day I remember I was teaching someone how to cook roasted broccoli. They had never done it before. They'd barely ever held a knife. You know, very new person in the kitchen. But their first instinct was, hey, you're going to hack off the florets and then throw the stem out. And I was like, that's the good part. You know, for me, I love the stem of broccoli. I think it's sweet, it's crisp, it's juicy. It's a totally different animal than, well, pardon me, a totally different vegetable than the florets of the broccoli. And that's when I thought, we are always throwing all this stuff out. So all the parts of the vegetables and fruits that you're throwing out, even if it's something as simple as just, okay, you keep it and you can use it as part of your stock. But, you know, when you start telling people about stock, like, their eyes glaze over, like, oh, my God, I'm never going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But something like broccoli stock, okay, if you don't want that as part of your particular dish, that's fine. But if you peel it and you shred it, it becomes an incredible slaw, right? You can use it in the place of coleslaw or just add it to your cabbage and coleslaw. It has a similar flavor but a different kind of texture. And a really crisp juiciness that's so lovely. Or you can cut the stalk into little slabs and char them up on the grill and serve them with a little pesto or a little, you know, chopped mint and parsley and nuts and olive oil. Like, that's incredible.
You know, the thing I was wondering about is people toss celery all the time. And what do you do with celery and celery leaves?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. When you bring home a bunch of celery, most of it, I think, gets ends up in the trash. You know, you take out the outer stalks, you have them in your potato salad or your chicken salad or whatever. And then when you get into the sort of yellowy stalks in the middle, like, people just think that's trash. But those hearts are, I mean, classically, you can braise them in a little bit of chicken stock and a little bit of cream. And since they're a little more tender to begin with, you kind of emphasize the fact that they're just kind of get a little melty. So they become delicious once you braise them down. You just take what they want to be and push them there. The other thing is the leaves. I mean, if you actually pluck off all the leaves on the tops of celery, which people, again, instinctively just go hack off that top bit, but you can actually pluck about 2 cups of leaves off a bunch of celery and, you know, rather than just toss them, you can figure out all these incredible things to do with them. If you taste one, they have a really intense flavor. They're sort of, I mean, they're very celery-like, but pushed to an extreme. So they're almost like licorice and a little bit like citrus. And someone, one of our writers came up with the idea of, well, use that in a pesto, and you have such an unusual pesto. You sub in the leaves instead of basil, a little bit of toasted almond instead of pine nuts, and you have this licorice-y, citrusy kind of pesto that's amazing with fish. Or you can mix celery salt. I mean, celery salt, I mean, everyone loves celery salt when you put it on deviled eggs, when you put it on hot dogs, if you're from the great city of Chicago. And you can just make that with these leaves. You pluck off the leaves, line them on a piece of paper towel on a plate, covered with another piece of paper towel, and you microwave them for about 30 seconds, give them a look, 30 seconds, give them another look. When they get a little brittle, then you can just take them off and basically just crumble them into salt or push them through a sieve into salt, and you have the freshest, most aromatic celery salt.
What a dynamite idea. You know, I saw that you even took on the peel of ginger.
Yeah, I was talking with Elizabeth Endo, who's this incredible resource on Japanese food. She's an American. She's lived there for 30 years. And she was telling me, you know, all these traditional ways that Japanese cuisines use the trims of their vegetable. It gets into this Buddhist philosophy of appreciation. And She was saying, you know, we were talking about ginger and how, you know, the first thing you do is you peel your ginger. And she said, yeah, but what happens is you have all this ginger peel. And really, if you try to taste it, it's really the same flavor. It's just a little dried. It could be a little papery. The texture is not that nice. But she gave us two really great ideas. One was basically simmering them in simple syrup with a little touch of soy sauce. And you create this sweet, gingery syrup sauce that you can use on ice cream.
Mm.
Or the other way around, where you use a lot more soy sauce than sugar, and, you know, soy sauce and a little bit of mirin, a tiny bit of vinegar, and basically you're just kind of stewing the peels until they tenderize. And then at the end of that, you get this really lovely condiment. It kind of takes all the edge off the ginger and makes it a really warm flavor. And you can use that, and, you know, you can just brush a little bit of fish, or you can even just eat it with rice. It's really amazing.
Francis, thank you. Great ideas.
Well, thank you.
Francis Lam is features editor of GuiltTaste.com. Now, for all the how-tos with celery, get thee to our website. That's SplendidTable.org. And take a listen to our culinary music feature as well. Chefs talking about the music they love to cook to. You'll find it all at SplendidTable.org. Just occasionally, a single simple thing stands a chance to change a lot of lives. An example, take a piece of cardboard and some foil, fold them correctly, and you have a solar oven. It could cook your dinner tonight. I mean, think of your fuel bill. Now take this idea to parts of the world where fuel is scarce and indoor cooking is dangerous. Now this is where Patricia McCardle is going, with solar cookers. She's a 27-year veteran of the diplomatic service. Now, her final assignment several years ago was as the Department of State's senior representative in northern Afghanistan. Patricia, good to have you with us. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So how did solar ovens come into the picture for you?
While I was in Afghanistan, my main job was traveling around with British soldiers on patrol to report on what we were seeing with the Taliban and that sort of thing. And what I noticed was all these little children hauling brush back to their mother's home so they could cook. And I noticed that it was very sunny. And I recalled that when I was a Girl Scout long ago, I had made a primitive box cooker out of cardboard and foil and a piece of glass. And I wondered if anyone in Afghanistan was doing that because they had a lot of sun and not much fuel. I did make some inquiries and found out that our government was not doing anything. But I went online, did some research, found the website of Solar Cookers International, which I'd never heard of, and they had some plans, which I downloaded, got some cardboard and foil from our British cooks in the field kitchen, built some solar cookers, and then started taking a very small one on patrol and demonstrating it to the amazement of the Afghan men who could see it.
Could the women see them?
Women do not go out in public in rural Afghanistan. And although I was able to visit some compounds because I was the only female on these patrols, but for group gatherings, it was men only. And so in the village square, when I would set up the solar cooker, it was men who saw it and were quite amazed by it and instantly figured out a use for it.
Huh. So let's say I'm an Afghani woman. How would I have been cooking up until the time a solar cooker comes into my life?
Afghan women, like about 2.5 billion people in the world, still cook over a 3-stone fire. It's three logs and 3 stones. The logs are ignited in the middle. The pot is set on the stones, and then the burning logs are slowly pushed into the center. It's an ancient way of cooking. It works very well, except that it generates a great deal of smoke, and it uses up a lot of wood. And today, with 6 billion people in the world and vanishing forests, it's not the best way to cook anymore.
Okay, so now I get a solar cooker. How would I cook now?
Well, you can, there are several types of solar cookers. If you used a box cooker or a panel cooker, you would put your food in a pot and put it in the cooker, point that at the sun, and it would cook very slowly, like a crock pot, between 250 and 350 degrees. Roasting, baking, or boiling your food. And the advantage is, because it's all enclosed, the food cooks slowly and evenly. Nothing burns. It doesn't reach burning temperature. And you don't need to add water or oil, because the juices from the cooked food just comes out very slowly. If you're using a parabolic cooker, which looks like sort of like an upside-down umbrella, millions of them are already used in China, that brings the sunlight into a very narrow point, and you put your pot on top just like you'd put it on a burner. That will cook very fast. It would substitute for a gas burner or a fire.
All right, but here's the question. Can I afford this cooker?
That's a very good question, and there are some super insulated ones that are several hundred dollars, and there are others that are quite simple, as the one that you described at the beginning, made of cardboard and aluminum foil, that only costs a few dollars, and they can actually be made of found materials, too. Cardboard can be found just about everywhere in the world now, and the ubiquitous juice boxes, potato chip bags that are sold almost everywhere. The inside of those is made of mylar, and that mylar can be glued onto cardboard to make a solar cooker. So in some places, people are actually using found materials to make these. And Solar Cookers International, the group I found on the Internet several years ago, I now serve on their board of directors. They are promoting solar cooking throughout the world with partnerships and by providing a lot of information on their website. There are many small solar cooking organizations and foundations that are supporting solar cooking, but we're hoping that large international organizations will begin supporting this technology.
Patricia, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Patricia McArdle serves on the board of Solar Cookers International and is author of the novel Farishta.
Talk to me. Talk to me. I love the things you say. Talk to me. Talk to me. In your own sweet gentle way. Let me hear.
It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. We are going to talk to you. Anything goes. Reach us at 800-537-5252. You can follow us on Twitter, connect with us on Facebook, shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see who's up. Anne is calling from Vineland, New Jersey. Anne, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How you doing?
I am doing swell. How about you?
Great, and I'm going to be doing better in a couple of weeks. My friends are having a tequila party.
Mm.
So, yes, it's going to be a Cabo Wabo Fest. But I do need to bring something to eat. And usually my husband and I bring either guacamole or like a black bean salsa, but we do that all the time. So I wanted to see if you had some ideas for something different.
Oh, boy. Okay. How about a sort of simplified version of some great street food from Mexico City?
Okay.
These are called taco al pastor. And what they are little palm-sized corn tortillas. So this means you eat a lot of them. It's a little corn tortilla. And you've got layers, thin slices of spiced pork. It's marinated with chili and, you know, probably garlic and oregano and that kind of thing. So you could do it at home by marinating, the pork, or cooking even a pork shoulder that you've thin sliced, marinated overnight and slow cooked in the oven. And then what you do is you could pull it apart, almost like pulled pork, and have those tortillas that you could warm, even on a grill. And then what you have is chunks of fresh pineapple, some raw onion, some fresh cilantro, and salsa.
Ooh.
And you can set it up in a way that people help themselves.
Okay.
And it really soaks up the tequila.
Okay. And I'm sure by the end of the night, no one's going to care what we're eating. But yeah.
I don't think they will, but in the beginning, they'll be terribly impressed.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
That's really great. And the thing is, everything is done ahead. And you can bring it, you know, all wrapped up individually, just plop it on plates or in bowls or whatever, and everybody helps themselves.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, so give it a shot.
Great. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Amy is calling from Caney, Kansas. Amy, hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I have been catching an overabundance of catfish lately. Well, not over. I have a lot of kids, so we eat it as much as we catch it.
Right.
And I fry it, and I fried it several different ways, and I've baked it in the oven with several different things, and my teenage child says fish again. And so I was wondering if you had any suggestions on how I could maybe cook it a little different than what I've been doing.
Ooh, okay. There is a way of making catfish that they do in Vietnam.
Okay.
And the kids, I think, are going to love it. And you cook it long and slow, believe it or not. You cut it into steaks, okay? Or you could have fillets.
Okay.
I mean, you could bone it out, but you can have it in kind of thick chunks, right? And the idea is you make a caramel. So you take a little water and you put sugar in it, and then you just melt that in a pan. Okay? And then once it gets to be very, very pale caramel color, you just scoop it into a metal bowl and set that aside. All right?
Okay.
And then you take your catfish, you do salt, pepper. Do they like hot food? You know, a little spice?
They do. They like a little spice.
All right.
You can throw in some hot peppers and
all right.
Eating with them.
So. All right. So you take that catfish, and what you do is you give it a little browning in a skillet. All right? Make sure it's sort of in an even layer in the skillet. And then you add to the skillet a bit of water and that caramel and a little bit of hot sauce. And you let that cook covered very, very slowly until the catfish is cooked through and it's sticky with that caramel.
Sounds really good.
It really is. And some people like to give it the littlest splash of vinegar. And what also sometimes is done is it's put away in the fridge and it's reheated later. So that really settles in and it permeates the fish. And even people who think they don't like fish at all really love it.
Well, that sounds really good. What would you serve with that?
Well,
we've been serving what's in season here, so.
Yeah, well, I'd serve whatever's in season there. But if you want to keep the Asian theme, you might do shredded cabbage and carrots that you've tossed with a bit of rice vinegar or any kind of vinegar or fresh lime juice or lemon juice and a little bit of sugar and a little bit of chili. And if you have some fish sauce and salt and pepper and then some rice, or take cherry tomatoes and stir fry them with ginger and garlic really fast so that they just begin to pucker a little bit. And you eat them at room temperature. And that on the plate with the catfish is really pretty.
Well, that sounds really good.
You're home free. You've got a whole new catfish take.
I do. I have a whole new catfish now. I appreciate it very much.
You are welcome.
And my kids will appreciate it very much.
You are welcome. Enjoy the catfish.
Well, thank you.
Bye.
You have a good day.
Bye. You too. 800-537-5252. Well, this week's trivia challenge is up, and the question is, why do we call drinking to someone's health toasting? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and we will be taking more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, so get in touch, connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email us, splendidtable.org, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, why do we call drinking to someone's health toasting? Well, one theory is from ancient Rome. Back then, wine went bad fast, but the Romans saw wine as a health drink, so they doctored it to preserve it and keep it from tasting lousy. They used lead for preserving, and then they absorbed the wine's sediment with either charcoal or burned spiced bread, and they called it toast. And, of course, that made it healthier, right? So in ancient Rome, you toasted to health. And you did that quickly before the lead got to you. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook. Aaron's on the line from South Korea. Aaron, what are you doing in South Korea?
Hi, Lynn. I am actually an English teacher in a public school here in South Korea.
How long have you been doing this?
So, I'm almost finished with my first year, and I've recently started taking my lunch to school. I have a few caveats with this, though, because the ingredients available to me here are not as varied as they are at home, and I also don't have anything like a microwave at school.
Uh-huh.
So essentially, I have to work with cold food or room temperature food.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out what to do to make a healthy lunch that I can take to school that doesn't have to be heated up, and I can work with what I have available to me in South Korea.
So what kinds of things are you working with?
I mean, there's actually a fair amount of produce. I have all kinds of meat. Spices is where it gets kind of limited. Cilantro is nearly impossible. I had to hunt down a basil plant. Chili paste is really prevalent here, but a lot of the things I'm used to eating at home, things like hummus, are very difficult, if not impossible, to find. And those are really easy things that I can make for lunch.
Right.
So just trying to figure out what I can do.
Well, what about things like, I'm thinking about, well, in Japanese it would be called edamame, but what about things like fresh soybeans? What about if you had fresh soybeans and you could puree that with a little bit of kimchi for spice, and you could have that with some fresh cabbage of some kind or green that you shred, put that on a bed of that, and that becomes essentially your main dish. And with that, you would have some kind of rice, and that would be a really right there. I mean, and none of that's going to spoil. Right? And it's going to be really, really tasty. And the other thing you can do with that puree and variations on that puree is you can pack the rice around it and make a rice ball.
Right.
And then, and you know, and that is one of the things. I mean, that's kind of a classic idea that you find all over Asia in one form or another. That, and you can make them small so that you can just have a few of them that you kind of, you know, in three bites you've eaten them. You can make them larger. And you put things in them that don't spoil. So you wouldn't put meat in them.
No.
But you could put any kind of legume in them. You could put vegetable combinations in them.
Yeah, that's kind of like a spin on what Koreans call kimbap.
Yeah.
Seaweed wrapped rice.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's the kind of thing that you could really do variations on. I mean, if you look at what the food is in the area and then look at how you can morph it into flavors that you're kind of used to, I think you're going to find it a little easier.
Yeah.
It's a hard adjustment living abroad. You know, from the outside looking in, probably everybody's saying, boy, how glamorous, how exciting. But when you're there, I didn't do it in Asia. I did it in Western Europe. But it gets lonely. And the food, even though it's an adventure, on the other hand, sometimes all you want is a hamburger and french fries. And you didn't care very much for hamburger and french fries when you were home. But when you're away,
Right. Yeah,
it's like,
It takes me 10 months to acquire a taste for kimchi. Now I love it. But when I first came here, I said, oh, fermented cabbage? Are you kidding me?
Exactly.
Actually, something I've become quite fond of is something called naengmyeon, which is a kind of chewy buckwheat noodle, which you serve cold with broth with some ice and vegetables, which I've done for lunch a lot.
That sounds great.
I've become a little burned out on it. That's why I wanted to ask you.
Well, you know, also, but, I think, wouldn't it be nice to have some of those legumes with some tofu with ice and either, you know, the cabbage or other fresh vegetable?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And bean curd tofu is available everywhere in every kind of firmness, softness, brand you would ever want. So,
hey, Erin, you're going to, it's going to yes. all be okay. It's going to be all
I
be
know. Okay. I can do this. I think this will be good. I'll work on this.
Okay. And you know, keep us posted and call again and I'll be thinking. Okay.
Absolutely.
All
Thank
right.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You are welcome. You can reach us 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Bennett is on the line from Colorado. Bennett, hi, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm going on a trip with my folks to Italy, and I've been asked to cook for one of the meals. And what are they going to have that I'm used to having in Fort Collins, and what can I do to kind of show off
okay.
you know, how we eat here?
Ah, good thinking, good thinking. Where are you going to be in Italy?
It's in Domodossola, so northern Italy, Piedmont.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Okay, so you're going to be up in the hills, if I remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. What have you got that you're familiar with that you really like to cook with?
Well, I really like to cook with pork, ribs, tenderloin. I love to cook with, ground beef, mm-hmm. Buffalo we have. I love tomatoes, like roasted red pepper and tomato soup.
You've got it. Okay. I think in Domodossola you're going to find great pork. It may not be cut the way you're used to having it cut, but what would be kind of fun, all right, it may make your Italian hosts do something that they don't usually do, which is eat with their fingers.
That's what I want them to do.
All right. All right. Go for the ribs that you love to make, okay? Go for that roasted tomato and pepper soup because the Piedmont has some gorgeous peppers and tomatoes. They're going to be practically, you know, falling out of the sky. I would make the meal you would make at home because I think you're going to find just about all the ingredients there. What kind of, how do you do your ribs? How do you love doing your ribs?
Well, it's interesting because I just heard a spot on your show where a girl and her husband had a difference. But I like to slow cook the ribs in the oven for all day long or as however long I have before we get too hungry with my guests. And I do add a little bit of water, like, to the bottom of the pan, but not to soak the ribs.
I understand, but just to keep things from burning?
Right.
Yeah.
And then when everybody's hungry and we can't wait any longer, then I crank up the heat of the oven and I'll put on some barbecue sauce and just kind of let them fall apart. And my favorite thing to do is to actually pull the bones out for everyone and serve that slice of rib meat on a tortilla with like some asparagus and some toasted pine nuts. And you really, really have to eat
that. Stop it, Bennett. I mean, we're dying here, for goodness sakes. I think, okay, the asparagus will be hard to find because it's late summer. I would tuck in your suitcase your favorite barbecue sauce, and I would take tortillas. They will never have seen a tortilla. And the barbecue sauce would probably be a bit foreign to them, and that's fine. And I think you should do exactly that.
Perfect.
Hey, you enjoy. It's going to be a fabulous trip. It's a wonderful part of Italy.
I'm looking forward to it.
Take care, Bennett.
Thank you very much.
800-537-5252. Shirley is calling from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Shirley, what is on your mind, madam?
I am wondering about how to store fresh ginger.
Oh.
I've tried all different ways, and I've read 36 other different ways. Putting it in a plastic bag in the refrigerator has failed sometimes, but not all the time.
Right.
I've wrapped it in paper towel and put it in a plastic bag, mm-hmm. which fails sometimes, but not all the time.
How long are you trying to keep it?
Probably 6 weeks. 4 weeks?
Okay, this is the thing. First of all, you got to keep it dry, which means if there's any moisture in the bag, and the paper towel's not a bad idea because if any kind of moisture develops in the bag, it'll suck it up. But 6 weeks for fresh ginger is a very long time. So here are a couple of options. The first week, week and a half, keeping it in the bag, unpeeled, in a whole piece is not a bad idea. A little paper towel to wick up and keep it in the refrigerator. But after that, there's several ways of doing it. One old way that was used in China changes the experience of the ginger, but it's really neat. What you do is you peel it and you thin slice it, and then you put it in sherry wine. A dry sherry, because dry sherry is a lot like the rice wine that's often used in Asian dishes. And what happens is, and you can just put that, you know, on the counter if you wish, or in the fridge, but you get a lovely ginger-flavored sherry to sip while you're cooking, and the sherry permeates the ginger ever so slightly, but the alcohol in the sherry releases flavors that are not released by any other substances. There are water-soluble flavors and alcohol-soluble flavors and oil-soluble flavors. And alcohol is the one that seems to release the broadest spectrum. So that little bit of alcohol, it just gives a nice lift to anything you throw that ginger into or chop it into. So that's number one. Number two is, again, peel it, thin slice it, spread it out the way you would, you know, fanning out a deck of cards. Okay, slip it in a heavy plastic bag, seal, get rid of all the moisture, and freeze it, and then just break it off as you need it. It's, you know, it's going to change the structure of it, but you're going to mince it up anyway. It's not like you're looking to use it whole. That will keep the flavor and the integrity of the ginger just as close as you can get to having it fresh. So either one of those, they're going to get two slightly different effects, but either one of those are dynamite.
All right.
But when you're trying to keep it for a real long time in the refrigerator, it starts to get nasty.
Right. So my son had told me to try vodka or tequila.
Same idea as the sherry.
Because you then end up with a nice flavored alcohol too.
Absolutely. Any kind of alcohol that you'd like.
Great. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you for a good question.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. Andrew's on the line from Pittsburgh. Andrew, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you today?
I am very good. How about you?
Good, good. I wanted to ask you about pizza crust. Now, growing up, my mom used to make pizza crust, and we'd have homemade pizza, and it was great and good and all that. And I've done the same now as an adult. But something's always missing for me, because I go out to some of these great pizzerias and various shops, and the crust sometimes is to die for. But I've never found a good recipe in all I've looked for that kind of mimics some of the great seasoning or just the undertones. Sometimes there's a sweetness to it. And, I mean, I've seen some of the things. Obviously, you can tell when there's cornmeal. I heard of from a friend who worked at a really great pizzeria that said they put lard in theirs.
That's
and
possible.
Obviously, that makes it delicious, of course. So I'm just wondering if you had any insights on if there are any some secrets, whether there's a good starter, something like that.
I'm looking through my secret box as we speak to decide should I or shouldn't I let it out. No, seriously, tell me what you like in a pizza crust. Do you like it crisp? Do you like it chewy? Do you like it tasting really of delicious bread?
Yes.
Okay,
you know,
all of
every time you want something a little bit different, and I had a great thin crust last night. It was fantastic. And I've had cornmeal crust that I love.
Well, the cornmeal thing is that it's not that the cornmeal's in the bread. It's that it's sprinkled on the peel. You know how in a lot of places they'll have ovens where you they'll put the pizza on this big piece of wood with a long handle on it. It's called the peel. But to keep that dough from sticking to the peel, they'll just put a generous layer of cornmeal. And then when they slip it into the oven, of course, that cornmeal sticks to the bottom and it roasts with it and you get that crunch. But the point is, okay, the best bread doughs and therefore pizza doughs are ones that are made with a small amount of yeast, really good flour, okay, and it's left to rise very, very slowly. And what they generally do in great pizzerias is that they start the dough the night before. Let's say for argument's sake, we have 2 cups of flour. You might have a quarter to maybe a half teaspoon of dry yeast. Then what you do is you mix that with a bit of warm water. You might add a little lard or a little olive oil. You let the yeast proof in that, you know, so it bubbles and you know it's alive. And then you mix the dough. And the dough is soft. The dough is not firm. It's really kind of soft and bordering on sloppy. And it could even be a little sticky. And you put that into a bowl. You cover it with some, you know, plastic wrap, and you let it sit at room temperature. And you can leave it for 14 hours if you want to.
So this is almost like a starter before you've made the whole dough?
Yeah, except that you've got all the flour in it.
All the flour's there.
All the flour's there. Oh. Now, after you've left it, it's going to go up and down and, you know, expand and contract. If it's really sloppy, you can beat in a bit more flour and work it a bit. But the idea is you can let it rise again if you want to, if you have the time. Or at this point is when you take it, you can dust it with a bit of flour so it's easy to handle, and this is where you shape it into the dough. And once you've shaped it into the shape that you want, you make it as thin as you possibly can. Now, if you want a cracker-like crust, what you do is you roll it out with a rolling pin until you can almost see through it.
Wow.
And then let it sit, because you want to rest it. Otherwise, it's going to be real tough.
Okay, so how long do you let it sit?
20 minutes.
Oh, now, is that true for any crust you would
I would say,
pull
yeah,
apart?
Once you've really manipulated a dough, you want to give it at least a 20-minute rest.
Maybe that's the problem I've always been having. I just slap it right onto the stone, load it up, and it's in the oven.
And it's tough tasting, and it's
catchy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, you want to give it a rest. It's been slapped around. It needs to recover. And then the idea is that then you put whatever you want on it, and you have the oven as hot as you can get it. You bake it on the bottom shelf, and you're off and running.
Great.
So now, and I think there's actually a pizza crust recipe on the website.
Okay.
Splendidtable.org. I think it's mine.
Okay. All right. It's got to be good then.
Well, it's not that, but I'm like you. I get very picky about the crust, and this was after a lot of trial and error. And it's a good place at least for you to begin.
Yeah.
You can change it. But take a look at that recipe. At least it'll give you a jumping off place.
Okay.
Okay?
Great.
All right.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can reach us any way you want. Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or call us, 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this from James Dent, who said, "A perfect summer day is when the sun is shining, the breeze is blowing, the birds are singing, and the lawnmower's broken." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every good cook should know. And take a look at our summertime grilling guide, 40 recipes to get you cooking outside this summer. All the information is, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Peters and Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.